This audio is brought to you by MuslimCentral.com.
الحمد لله نستعينه ونستغفره ونستهديه ونعوذ بالله من شرور أنفسنا من سيئات أعمالنا من يهدي الله فلا مضل له ومن يضلل فلا هادي له وأشهد أن لا إله إلا الله وحده لا شريك له وأشهد أن محمدا عبده ورسوله صلى الله عليه وعلى آله وصحبه وسلم رب اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي أمري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقه قولي وقني شر نفسي وفلت لساني وان اضل 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 بغير حقي رب العالمين وبعد السلام عليكم ورحمة الله and good evening. The hour is late and I am very fearful of trying your patience more than it can bear. And I was told in the invitation that I got here that I have to limit myself to 20 minutes. And they actually put that in capital letters, which suggested to me that they were very serious. And so what I'm going to try and do is make maximum use of my time, and rather than go through a detailed thank you for all the people who are responsible for affording me this opportunity to come here and speak to you tonight, I just want to sort of issue a general thank you and to say congratulations to CARE for its institutional longevity and its ability to establish itself and the importance of the work that it does as is manifested by the outcome tonight and the level of support that it has received. What I want to try and do myself tonight is sort of, in a way, contextualize the situation as I see it with regard to what CARE itself dedicates itself to doing, and that is the relationship between Muslims and non-Muslims in America. That is what is being captured by the whole title of the Council on American-Islamic Relations. And what I want to try and do is to give us a sense of the fact that what is happening with regard to Muslims in America today is not simply happening to Muslims. It's happening to America, and it's happening in America. And I think that we as Americans, as a society, we have to recognize this fact, and we have to arm ourselves and so that we are not prey to the various and sundry machinations that seek to take us down a path that we have been down before with other communities, that we should have learned from before with regard to the experience of those other communities, and that we have to dedicate ourselves to not going back down again. So what I want to try and do is contextualize this whole enterprise and hopefully provide us with a way of thinking more critically and more holistically about the kinds of challenges and opportunities that we confront as Muslims, be we Muslim, as Americans, I'm sorry, be we Muslim or non-Muslim. Now, in 1940, there was a very famous case right here in Pennsylvania called Minersville School District versus Gobias. And this case actually went all the way to the Supreme Court. And it was about a group of Jehovah's Witnesses students whose parents had basically said that they should not salute the American flag. And the students were told by their parents that they could stand up in respectful silence, but that they would not recite the actual words pledging allegiance to the flag. And so the Minersville School District, by the way, which is right here in Pennsylvania, basically tried to compel these students to pledge allegiance to the flag. And the case ended up going all the way to the Supreme Court. By 1940, you have to remember, this is during or on the precipice of World War II. This is a very trying time for the country as a whole. And so by an 8-1 vote, the Supreme Court insisted that the Minersville School District had a right to require students to recite the Pledge of Allegiance to the flag, despite any religious misgivings that they might have about this very gesture. And the Supreme Court's position was championed by Justice Felix Frankfurter. And Justice Frankfurter had no ill will towards the Jehovah's Witnesses themselves, but he insisted that America as a society, in order for it to flourish, in order for it to be able to come to its fullest capacity, required the existence, the promotion, and the preservation of what he referred to as cohesive sentiment. And that is to say that Americans must be bound together by some emotional / psychological glue that enables the society to function in a cooperative manner. And that if you allow certain groups or individuals to opt out of that cohesive sentiment, then the society itself would not be able to function as a whole, and we would not be able to put forth the kind of efforts that we need to put forth to rise to the challenges that were facing the country at the time. And so the school children were told by the Supreme Court of the United States that they had an obligation, despite their religious misgivings, to pledge allegiance to the flag. 3 years later, however, in another case, West Virginia State Board of Education versus Barnett, a very similar case, the Supreme Court, by a 6-3 majority, reversed itself and overruled the ruling that it had given in Gobitis. And in his majority opinion, Justice Robert Jackson, noted the following. And I'm going to quote here. If there is any fixed star in our constitutional constellation, it is that no official, high or petty, can prescribe what shall be orthodox in politics, nationalism, religion, or other matters of opinion, or force citizens to confess by word or act their faith therein. In other words, the Supreme Court was saying that while Justice Frankfurter's concern for the cohesive sentiment, that emotional and psychological bond that enables us to act in unison with a degree of empathy for each other as a society, while this might be important, it was not, and emphatically not, the role of the government to try to force this cohesive sentiment into place. Moreover, any attempt on the part of government to try to force this cohesive sentiment was subject to actually producing the opposite effect. For by targeting one segment of the population as being insufficiently patriotic, the government would send a subliminal message to the rest of society that it was actually patriotic to hate or suspect or discriminate against that group that it had identified as being insufficiently patriotic. And so in the name of actually promoting this so-called cohesive sentiment, the government actually would end up undermining that sentiment by actually spawning hatred and distrust in the society. This, in a real sense, is actually a part of what we're seeing unfold right now. And in my estimation, this whole anti-Sharia legislation has to be mindful of the effect that is likely to take. And rather than just address those people who are behind these kinds of machinations, it is important that the people in this room, Muslim and non-Muslim alike, understand what these kinds of machinations are likely to do to our society. And that these machinations cannot take effect without our permission. If we rise in opposition to these kinds of efforts, then those efforts themselves will be stopped in their tracks. And we have to understand that these are not efforts that will simply affect Muslims alone. But in fact, we will be unleashing forces and giving them permission to express themselves in the open public. And once that permission has been given, it will be very difficult to take it back. Nor will we be able to determine who will be the object of that very negative energy. But in point of fact, I did not come here tonight to talk about this anti-Sharia legislation. In point of fact, that to me is sort of a side point. It's only a symptom of the problem. And so what I want to do is move on to what I see as the real issue that confronts us. And my main point here is the following. Cohesive sentiment, or we might even just say mutual respect, or as I'll talk about a little later on, what Islam would recognize as a general fraternity within society. This is important for us as Americans. In fact, it's important for any modern society. The reality is that we are so interdependent upon each other that it is important that we conduct ourselves collectively in a manner that produces and allows for the flourishing of healthy individuals in our society. Because we can have all the segregated communities we want. We can have whites living in one area, blacks living in another, Muslims living in one area, Jews, Christians, atheists, others living in another, people with money living in one area, people with no money living in another. But the reality of the matter is that we all live in this society, and therefore we intersect with each other on various and sundry occasions. And the very person that I might think I have no relationship to at all, I may find myself in a position where I am fundamentally dependent on that person for this or that particular service. Let me give you a concrete example of what I'm talking about here. I just moved to California not too long ago, and we bought a little house out there. And I'm new to the area, so I got a bill in the mail, I thought it was a bill, from the county assessor's office. But it had the old owner on the address. So my wife said, forward to, you know, addressee, that person doesn't live here. So we didn't think it had anything to do with us. And a few months later, I get a letter addressed to me saying, if you don't pay these taxes, you have a problem. I said, I never got a tax bill. So I called up the county assessor's office. And I get this person on the phone who just doesn't understand. And I'm trying to reason with this person, and they don't get it. And I'm trying to reason, and they don't get it. And they don't get it. And my point to you is this. I don't know that person, and that person doesn't know me. But the reality is that they have the capacity to bring virtual ruin to my life. And if that had been a black person, who said, I don't like white folks, and anybody who calls here and even sounds white, I'm gonna check the wrong box. Or he's a Muslim, or a Jew, or whatever. And anybody who calls here and don't sound like the kind of people I like, I'm checking the wrong box, and they're gonna have some issues to deal with. And so this is part of the point that I'm making, that no matter how we might try to segregate ourselves in society, all right, we are dependent upon each other. For the purity of our water, right? For the nutritious value of our food. Just imagine when we get alienated individuals who turn into psychopaths and have no empathy for society at large. Imagine the kind of damage that they can do. And so this business of cohesive sentiment is very important for us to be able to function as a society. The government will protect us one from the other. But government cannot put that cohesive sentiment in place. That is ultimately up to us. And we as a society have to figure out what we are going to do in order to preserve the quality of life that we as groups and individuals want to enjoy in this country. Do we want to live in a country where, despite the fact that your religion, your culture, your color, your race is different from mine, I can depend on the fact that there is a modicum of mutual empathy that will bring you to see me as a human being, as a fellow citizen, and deal with me on the basis thereof. You don't have to like me. You don't have to agree with me. You don't have to even think that I'm handsome. But you recognize a basic degree of empathy that brings you to deal with me in a manner that is equitable. Or do we want to unleash those negative forces that put us in a position where we cannot move about in society trustful that the people with whom we are interacting have that kind of empathy, will not do things to bring us gratuitous harm and things of that nature? So what we're talking about here is how we, as people who live in America, people who are American, Muslims and non-Muslims alike, we're talking about how we are going to relate to each other, what kind of relationship we're going to have with each other. And when we start talking about relationships, one of the most common mistakes that can be made is that one party in the relationship basically says, everything will be all right if the other party does what they're supposed to do. This is the way we try to manipulate ourselves into a sort of privileged position, whereby the relationship will be sustained, all right? If you offer your services to me, and I just sit back and receive your services. Whereas in point of fact, relationships are by definition dialectical in nature. And they are only preserved and enhanced by the commitment of both parties. Even if I'm wrong, and I come to you and I apologize, that apology will go nowhere if you are not psychologically predisposed to accepting that apology. Or it might not go anywhere if I'm not willing to accept the fact that what I've done is so egregious that it may take you a little time to fully adjust to my apology. My point is simply that one party in a relationship cannot preserve a relationship. The relationship, in order for it to be preserved and perpetuated, can only be preserved and perpetuated by the mutual commitment of both parties. And so what I want to do with the few minutes that I have remaining is speak to both parties in this relationship. And I think, again, it is important for us to recall that as Americans, whether we like it or not, we have a relationship with each other. We are drawn into this relationship by the mere fact that we are Americans. We live together. We play together. We work together. We have a relationship. And we have to figure out how we're going to make that relationship work best for us. And so I have three considerations. Three considerations for our non-Muslim citizens and three considerations for our Muslim citizens. In other words, we want to look at what? Both sides of this relationship. And I want to say just a few words very briefly about what I think might contribute to the health and the substance of that relationship if we can be brought to consider these things. So to our non-Muslim compatriots, the first thing I want to say is that one of the reasons that many non-Muslims have this this bit of difficulty with the presence of Muslims in American society. And by the way, I should say here that I'm talking about America as a whole. I think that the situation in Philadelphia is a bit different from what it is in other parts of the country. Philadelphia is a very, very Muslim city. And it is very difficult for non-Muslims not to have some kind of interaction with Muslims on some level or another in a city like Philadelphia. But in the country at large, all right, in places where much of the rhetoric is emanating from, one of the reasons that rhetoric gains such traction is that Muslims are looked upon as being these newcomers to America. And newcomers are always, well, there's a tendency, I should say, to look at newcomers through a certain prism of xenophobia. It's new, and therefore, I have to figure out how I'm going to adjust to it. While Muslims are looked at as new in America, the reality is they are not new. Muslims have been here for centuries, for a very, very long time. And this is not simply rhetoric. We have the physical record of Muslims who were present in this country in the 17th, in the 18th, and the 19th centuries. And the only reason that we think that they are new today is that our country at that time was of a mindset where those people, as Muslims, were excluded from inclusion in American society. And they were excluded simply because they happened to be African slaves. And so part of what I want our non-Muslim compatriots to consider is that if Muslims had not been excluded 200 years ago, then maybe we would be looking at a situation right now where society at large would be much more comfortable in its dealing with Muslims. And the very idea that Muslims are looked upon as some new entity, that is not the fault of Muslims. Muslims didn't do that. That is the fault of the dominant culture in America. And by the way, Muslims were not the only ones. But I want to call your attention to this. And this is the real point that I want to make. 100 years ago, we need to think about the kinds of things that were being said about Catholics in this country. Catholics in this country were a great threat. Catholics in this country were going to drag this country under the yoke of the Pope in Rome. In fact, the whole movement toward public education was in part designed to control the rising tide of Catholicism in America. We wanted to take those children out of these Catholic schools and to put them in these public schools where they could be socialized in a way that we were more comfortable with. And so Catholics themselves were looked upon as a threat. But because Catholics were recognized as Americans, they were able to conduct themselves in a manner in which, over a period of time, they proved that we're not here to destroy America. America is home for us. We're here to carve out a dignified existence for ourselves, just like everybody else in America wants. And because of the longevity of the Catholics being recognized in America, today, we don't think about this, but it's a fact. The highest court in the land today is dominated by Catholics. There are 9 Supreme Court justices, 5 of them are Catholics. And so what we have to imagine is that if Muslims had not been excluded, and if Muslims are not excluded, Muslims will be as integrated in this society as anyone else, and there will be none of this fear about what Muslims are trying to do to America. Because it will be recognized that America is just as much home to Muslims as it is to anybody else. So that's the first thing that our non-Muslim compatriots could consider. The second thing, and this is a very important point to consider, is that oftentimes in the rhetoric non-Muslims tend to ask Muslims, well, what do you think about X? What do you think about wine drinking, for example? And the Muslim will give an answer based on his or her understanding of Islam. And they will say something like, well, we believe that wine drinking is something that you should not do. From here, non-Muslims then adopt the notion that if Muslims morally condemn something, then this will automatically be translated into some political platform in which they want to impose that upon everyone else. This is false. There are any number of things in Islam that Muslims understand that we as Muslims are not going to do that. I'm not going to eat a ham sandwich. But I'm not going to pass a law saying that no one in society can eat a ham sandwich. And these are all little issues, but this is the implication. I want to invite you as non-Muslims to abandon that understanding, to abandon that notion. Islam has always been a pluralistic religion. And Islam did not need modern liberalism to teach it about tolerance. And let me give you just one concrete example of what I'm talking about here. What's the time? Okay. There is a very prominent scholar named Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah. And he himself was the pupil of an even more prominent scholar. And they came to him, and by the way, this is 800 years ago. Not in the modern liberal age, 800 years ago. And they came to him and asked him, we have these Zoroastrians who live in our society. And they believe in this practice of self-marriage. A man marrying his daughter, marrying his mother, marrying his sister. What should we as the Muslim power do about this? This was Ibn Qayyim's answer. If the Zoroastrian community does not seek our adjudication, we don't do anything about it. If the Zoroastrian community does seek our adjudication, we judge them on the basis of their religion, not on the basis of ours. This is Ibn Qayyim al-Jawziyyah. Now, of course, these issues are debated among Muslim jurists, and I'm not trying to whitewash the issue here, but the very fact that they are debating shows that Islam has always discussed the exact parameters of tolerance, and that tolerance was not something that is alien to Islam. And so for Muslims to be perfectly believing, practicing Muslims in their own communities and in their own personal lives does not necessarily at all imply that they are going to try to hold you as a non-Muslim element in our society to the very same standard. And so when those people come to you with all this scary talk about Sharia, this is one of the things that we should keep in mind. The last thing that I would like to suggest that our non-Muslim compatriots think about is that Muslims are not new to discrimination in America. And if you are Jewish, if you are Catholic, if you are Irish, if you are Italian, you should know something about discrimination. And you should sometimes reflect on how your communities responded to that discrimination. And in that context, you should understand that America is not always right. It's not always wrong, but America is not always right. And when Muslims or non-Muslims react to America's wrongs, we cannot always simply blame those people who are reacting to wrongs and give American society or the American government a pass. Nor can we all the time assume that whatever problems a Muslim may have with America is necessarily grounded in some understanding of Islam, as opposed to their actual experience as a marginalized minority that has been discriminated against. And let me give you just one concrete example here. Every time I've given this example, I've gotten the same response. It's 10:30 at night, you're a black male in his 30s. You're riding somewhere in backwater, anywhere in America. Your car breaks down, your cell phone battery is out, so you're gonna have to go knock on someone's door for help. You come upon a patch of houses. Two houses, let us say. One of those houses has an American flag hung out front. The other house has no flag hung out front. Which of these houses are you gonna knock on?
Other one. Other one.
In the majority of cases that I've given this example, people have said, I will knock on the door of a house with no flag. Is that because blacks hate America? No, it's because that flag has been used as a symbol to terrorize black Americans. And that experience is real for them. All right? And so if Muslims have a problem with this or that aspect of American symbolism, let us not just immediately run to Islam for some kind of explanation for that. Rather, we should perhaps look at what experience that Muslim community is being shown in America as an explanation for why they might have this particular predisposition towards America. And as Americans, we should dedicate ourselves to changing that experience rather than holding their religion in suspicion. Because any community that is discriminated against on what feels like an official basis will internalize certain feelings about that polity that will not be positive. And so we have to be careful, our non-Muslim compatriots, about assuming that everything negative that Muslims may feel or say about America is necessarily grounded in some kind of understanding of Islam. Rather, it may simply be grounded in their experience. But as I said, there are two sides to any relationship. And simply to address the non-Muslims about the kinds of energies that are animating Islamophobia without addressing the Muslim community in terms of what it may be contributing to the dynamic in American society right now is irresponsible and it's ineffectual. Because as I said, relationships are dialectical. And it will take both sides examining themselves and committing to righting whatever it sees as being wrong in its perspective. And so I have three suggested sort of considerations for the Muslims. The first is we have to abandon what I would almost characterize as this plantation mentality that many of us still nurse. And this plantation mentality takes two forms. One with the immigrant community, those who came to America post-1965. And this takes the form of sort of almost wanting to bend over backwards, sort of to show that we are here to do good for American society. 5 minutes? Or was that 5,000? And I don't mean that Muslims should not do good to American society. But if America is really home and not some plantation that belongs to someone else, why do you always have to overexpress your commitment to doing good to your own society? I travel in the Muslim world all the time. I don't hear that tone there. Huh? When I travel to the Muslim world, yes, people want to serve their society as their society. But not as, no, we want to serve. You don't have that there. Because they are home. They are home. They do not see themselves as guests in someone else's society. And because they don't see themselves as guests, they don't conduct themselves in a manner that looks almost desperate. And when you come to me with any proposal that feels desperate, number one, I'm likely to hold you in contempt, because nobody likes desperate people. And number two, I'm not likely to believe you. So one of the first things that we have to do is we have to abandon that aspect of this plantation mentality. If America is truly home, then treat it as home. And demand of others that they see you as participating in the welfare of your own society. It's sort of like many of you, I'm sure, saw the movie Braveheart. And there's the guy coming from Ireland. And he says, what? Ireland. She's mine. That's the attitude that Muslims have to have about America. If we are Americans, then America is mine. And there's no question about whether we want to do good to our own society. In the Black American community, I still have 3 minutes. Okay. In the Black American community, sometimes this is manifested in this whole idea that, you know, it's a measure almost of Islamic piety to the extent that we are hesitant or we reject our Americanness. And I want to be clear right here. There are some people who have had very negative experiences in America. They have been falsely arrested, they have been falsely imprisoned, and they have been abused in prison. As an experience, they are too bitter to really look upon America in any positive light. I'm not talking about those people. I'm talking about those people who see opposition to being American as some kind of ideological, defensible position in Islam. And this we have to be very, very careful about. America will only be resisted by me if I see her as what? Somebody else's property. America is not somebody else's property. I've been here since 1619. Longer than many of the people who claim ownership over America today. America is my society. And I have my America, just like other communities have theirs. 2 quick points and I'm out. Can I? Okay. All right. The second thing that Muslims have to consider is that, listen, you don't have a constitutional right to be liked or culturally accepted. If we want to be liked or culturally accepted, we have to earn that right, and or we have to organize to the point that we can bring people to treat us fairly in the way that we believe we should be treated fairly. But we don't have any constitutional right for people to treat us any particular way in the public space. And this means that this is going to get a little subtle, Imam Siraj, but Islam has no use for cowards. We're not living in that time today. So I'm going to say, this means that Muslims have to unlearn some things about our own post-colonial experience. The colonizers came to the Muslim world, and Muslims came to understand the West as being this antithesis to Islam. The West came for the express purpose of undermining, destroying, and subjugating Islam. Muslims therefore reacted, and they adopted a cultural expression of Islam that would insulate them against the incursions of the West. But that was before a time when it became apparent that the West itself would produce its own Muslims. And we have to unlearn some of those cultural impulses from our past. And we have to learn that we have to be culturally imaginative, just like the early Muslims were. Culturally imaginative, culturally confident, culturally proud, culturally innovative. And I'm not worried about our cultural capacities here in America. We have proven we have plenty of cultural capital. This is my last point. You're making me nervous, so I'm going to just get to it and be out of here. The last point that Muslims, I think, need to consider is that while we may not call it cohesive sentiment, its functional equivalent is not only important, but absolutely justifiable from the perspective of Islam. In the Quran, it's referred to more as ukhuwa, brotherhood, fraternity. And the point that I want to make here is this. The Quran itself recognizes that all societies are defined by and need a modicum of fraternity in order for them to function. And the Quran depicts several societies, in fact, virtually all of them, as being societies in which prophets came to them as what? As brothers. There was a fraternal bond between the prophets and even the people that rejected them. وَلَعَادٍ أَخَاهُمْ هُودًا وَلَثَمُودَ أَخَاهُمْ صَالِحًا وَلَمَكَنَ أَخَاهُمْ شُعَيْبًا. Even Lut, not in Surah Al-A'raf, a lot of people go on, but even Lut, the people of Lot, being engaged in what they were engaged in, what does the Quran say? It refers to them, وَكَتَبَتْ قَبْلَهُمْ قَوْمُ نُوحٍ وَأَسْحَابُ الرَّسِّ وَثَمُودُ وَعَادٌ وَفِرْعُونَ وَإِخْوَانُ لُوطٍ. That these societies rejected all of the prophets. And then it comes to Lot, and it refers to those people as whom? The brothers of Lot. And so this fraternal sentiment is not something alien to Islam. It is not something that we should feel is being imposed upon us by the society that we live in. This fraternal sentiment is Quranic. This fraternal sentiment is part of the Sunnah of the Prophet. And I will end right now with this. The Prophet himself, sallallahu alayhi wa sallam, was brutalized by his society, scandalized, lied about, using Islamophobia as something. He was even forced to leave his society, fearful of his physical health. And so he left and went to Medina. When the Prophet came back into Mecca triumphant years later, he said to them, What do you think I'm going to do to you? What did they say to him? Akhun Kareem. Ibn Akhun Kareem. You are a generous brother and the son of a generous brother. And what did the Prophet say? Go. You are free. That is the functioning of that fraternal spirit. Jazakallah khairan.